This is an interview with Dr. John White for the Youngstown State University Little Red Schoolhouse Restoration Project by Michelle Blum, and it's done at Youngstown State University on April 9th, 1984 at 1 p.m. You've been involved in working with several of the projects locally. The Austin Log Project. How has archaeology helped with that project?
We've done locally, historically, we've done been involved with half a dozen projects, all of which, it seems to me, are now National Register sites, mm-hmm. and archaeology has played an important, or if not dominant, role in the successful mm-hmm. restoration of every one of the sites that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Now, we did the Austin Log House. The first one we did was the Eden Hopewell Furnace in Yellow Creek. That won't entail any restoration, at least not in the foreseeable future. That's literally so much of an archaeological remain that the only information that could be learned from it was actually digging it, you know? Mm-hmm. There isn't any structure there to be restored. They had thought at one time of putting a pavilion over the site and preserving it as a permanent ruin. After we did the Eaton Log House, we went to Austintown and we did the Austin Log House at the invitation of the people from Austintown who in the 70s, early 70s, had uncovered, they were destroying a house out there, they were raising a house, and then taking down the gingerbread from the outside, they saw that it was actually a log house, two-story log house underneath, right? Mm-hmm. They decided to try to restore it and to learn as much as they could about the site, so they called us out. To make a long story short, we went out there with a government grant to specifically answer questions such as how old was the site. They never quite knew how old the structure was. They wanted to know how old it was, so it wasn't part of the written record. History couldn't help them there. Mm-hmm. We also wanted to try to see if we could tell them what kind of uses the land on which the cabin was located were put during the course of the years that the cabin was there. That's something you couldn't learn about from history because people didn't calendar those events. You simply don't have people writing day-by-day logs of, well, today we went out and milked the cows, you know? Okay, so we dug out there for two summers, uncovered thousands of artifacts, uncovered the remains of the old barn, uncovered the remains of a well, a stock well in the field, a half a dozen sheds that they didn't know existed, two privies that they didn't know existed, and again, isn't part of the historical record. If you're not digging Monticello, you don't have maps as to where the old privies were located. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And we uncovered all those things. The only way they could have been turned up was by archaeology. Then we wrote a report, which Ken Zins probably told you was going to be published. In fact, its date of publication is the first week in May. We're going to have a big book signing session out there in Austintown. But the data that we recovered archaeologically is really all the data they have about the cabin other than the structure itself, see? And then the artifacts that we found, we brought back to the lab and cleaned up and repaired and restored, did our own historical restoration of the artifacts, recreated broken pottery and stuff like that. And that is going to go on exhibit. In fact, it's on exhibit now at the Austin Log House. The second floor is a museum. And in the cases are the artifacts that were recovered archaeologically.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of work serves two functions. It specifically gives you data about the site you're digging, both hard and soft data that they themselves can use. Secondly, and perhaps even more important, every time you do a site like that, it adds to the general data bank of archaeological restoration in general. That is, there's no reason why a guy in San Francisco wouldn't be interested in our work at Austintown because we've learned something about digging sites that will be helpful to him all the way out there. Every time you dig a site, you learn a new methodology or a new technique that helps you at the next site you dig. You know what I mean? So you get better at it and you refine your techniques through time. So the information you get is both helpful site-specific and in a general way. Now, all right, so that's what we did. Now, if you'd like, I can just, I was going to tell you some other sites we dug, or do you have a specific question there that you have to follow?
No.
Okay, no. Well then when we're done with the Austintown Log House, I think our next job was the Barnheisel House in Girard. In fact, I just got a call from the Vindicator about that. Barnheisel House is a National Historic Site in Girard, right across from the old Girard Leatherworks. And they thought they had a site, a house, which had been a way station on the Underground Railroad during the Civil War. And we told them that we'd look in the basement to see if we could find any tunnels coming out. And while doing that, in the winter of 79, we found they did not have tunnels, which didn't mean they were not a way station on the Underground Railroad, just meant that they didn't have tunnels that were part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But while we were there, we discovered the remains of a raised wing that had once been attached to the house that no one knew about. And so during the spring of 80, in the summer, we dug a wing the size of this office building, maybe this office building. Not this office, but the whole suite.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, we took out thousands and thousands of artifacts that dated from the occupation of the house up until it was raised in 1930. That stuff just gave back to them Friday. And the monograph from that is a couple hundred pages long. And that data is going back to them, and they will do the same thing. They will take the restored bottles and artifacts. We had bone hairbrushes and toothbrushes and 2 cent pieces and all sorts of artifacts, typical household artifacts. They'll put them on display. And they will now know. For example, in this case, if you were restoring the Barnheisel House, you wouldn't have known without archaeology that it once had a wing on it.
Mm-hmm.
They thought it was just a typical New England type house, but we were able to show them there was actually a wing on it. So now, if you were going to restore that, they are restoring but not putting the wing back on it. So we added that dimension to it.
Mm-hmm.
Then we did Lineman's Mill. Now, the question arose there. They got $600,000 to restore that. I don't know if you've seen what they've done, but they have $600,000. Before they put their money in it, they wanted to know whether or not they were going to have to put a turbine in there or a water wheel. As you know, there's a water wheel in there now. They didn't know if the first motive power for the mill was streaks, was water-powered turbine or water wheel. So they called me on the phone and they said, is there any way we can tell? I said, yes, there is. If there was a water wheel, then they would have a mill race, head race attached, and it would be here, and they said where it would be expected to be found. Now there's no sign of it now. So they said, can you tell us? I said, sure. So we went out in the spring of 81, and we excavated all spring, and we discovered the old head race leading from the river right into the side of the wall. We uncovered it, we dug for several months, and now that's uncovered, and if you go to the mill now, you can see the race we uncovered, and the water coming through it, and they knew then that it was a water wheel instead of a turbine. And I can remember just as though yesterday, the day that they had about a dozen engineers and the members of the fund who were giving the $600,000. They stood up on the bank and I got down into my excavation pit and they said, okay, convince us that there was a water wheel here and not a turbine, because we're going to spend money. As it turned out, I spent $50,000-$60,000 on the water wheel, so they wanted to know that, you know, what it was. So I said, here's why there was a water wheel. It took me 10 minutes and I gave them the whole explanation. They said, sold, and they have a water wheel. So here, archaeology was able to tell them something that they did not historically know.
Mm-hmm.
Our next move after that was a series of digs that I started in western Pennsylvania at a place called Quakertown, in which we have 800 acres of a settlement that originated in 1700 and ceased to exist in 1799. And we're excavating on a year-round basis. We have for the last 3 years different houses out there. Now, Quakertown, everything that's ever been known about Quakertown could be done on 2 single-spaced pages that size. I mean, it just isn't much about a rural community that ceased to exist in 35. You know?
It's really strange. That there was so little information about it.
Yeah, well, see what happens in a case like this. A rural community never had a newspaper. It reached its peak about 1875. It was all the people that lived there worked in Lowellville. All it was a was a community that was made up of individuals of which we knew more about them. That is, the relationship to the people who lived there and know something about their family. The biggest pile of information we've got have been from talking to people who told us about their family line. But see, the genealogies go so far. Genealogies don't tell you at all about house structures or how many room houses they had. And as the people die off that live there, the relationships to them can't help it. So we talked to the grandson of the guy who founded it. He knows less about the place than I do. Huh? So archaeology is the only way that information gets back. The old question used to be, why dig it when you can read about it? And that was a decent question in the extreme, except that we've come to find out that very often you cannot read about it, and it isn't recorded, and very often history has a tendency to be very subjective. And that being the case, archaeology is extremely objective. That is, if the wing is right here when you dig it up, there's no way in the world that it can be over here. That is, it's scientifically unbiased, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Which doesn't mean that we can't interpret it wrong, mm-hmm. but at least if we interpret objectively, we come up with, sometimes we find things that are sort of contra to the written record, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Because historians tended, at least the old-fashioned ones especially, tended to polish up history a little bit, mm-hmm. you know? They tended to gloss over it and to do this, that, and the other thing. The last restoration project, and the one that was an ideal example of what you're talking about, was in Mansfield, where we dug, I took a crew over there, and with government grant money, done the Oak Hill Cottage, which was a beautiful summer cottage of this doctor who was one of the founding families of Mansfield. And they were going to, they were putting a lot of money into Mansfield and the Richland Historical Center, and a lot of money into restoring that site. The rooms are all going to be done in the Victorian thing, you know what I mean? They have all the costumes from the period. The house, when it was given to them, was literally full of stuff from, it was like somebody stopped the clock in 1890. Mm. And the house is absolutely stunning, absolutely stunning. So they didn't know anything about the grounds, though. It's located in the middle of downtown Mansfield now, but it was once an estate of about 16 acres. Of which there's maybe now an acre and a half surrounding. They wanted to know where there were walks, if there were walkways and gardens. So our excavations tended to be aimed toward showing them where their gardens were, where the walkways were, where the carriage house was, where the privies were, and all that sort of thing. And the reason I mentioned that one is that the guy who was in charge of that project was a historical landscape, okay? From New York. I'm trying to find a treatise here. Now he's from New York, okay? Mm-hmm. And they have lent that to Chuck. I did. I don't have it with me. But he presented his recommendations as to what they should do landscape-wise. But in there as an appendix was my archaeological report and my 16 recommendations that I made based on the archaeology. The long and short of it is that archaeology is an integral part of restoration. You can't do it successfully without. I offer you to pause it and turn that off for a second. And you can...
Okay, are you familiar with the Little Red Schoolhouse project in Poland?
Do you know that, bro? Are you connected with that in some...
Sort of.
Are you from Poland?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I'll tell you two things about that. Years ago when they first discovered its importance, that was about 5 years ago. I mean, they've always known about it, but when they first got interested in it, when it was, I guess it was given over from the community to the Board of Education, somebody had it first. When they got interested, it was a nice article by Janie Jenkins in the paper, and I called the people who were connected with it. They said, I'll dig it out there for you. I'll do a nice supportive dig around there to find any outbuildings, privies, and anything to, if you restore it, you can bring the whole, they have a nice big chunk of land, so they have the opportunity to landscape it. Now, when I was there, it was landscaped. I mean, by that I mean there were paths, there were maybe plots. It behooves their restoration to return it from what it is now to what it was before. The only way they can do that is to dig it, to find out where the trails were, where the paths were, where the privies, the cisterns, the wells, and all that business. And I told them I would. And then I didn't hear from them because it was in limbo as to who had permission to, who had it. Well, then they started to put it on the National Register. And now I'm on the government's advisory board for historic site preservation.
Poland Historical Society project.
Well, I offered to put it on the register form.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, no, we're doing it. We'll take care of that. And that was Rebecca Rogers, I guess, or somebody that was doing that. And it turns out, this is ironic, that I was told down there that they're just not accomplishing it. So they turned the, just a couple of weeks ago, they turned the Little Red Schoolhouse over to one of my trained people, Evelyn Manji,
mm-hmm.
who's from Poland. And she is now doing the work to put it on the National Register of Historic Places,
mm-hmm.
okay? So again, it comes back to the archaeology. We have a course here called Cultural Resource Management,
mm-hmm.
which goes hand in hand with, are you far along in the history department or what?
I'm a M.A.
Okay, well, you're working on your M.A.
M.A.,
or
yes.
You are an M.A.
I'm working on my M.A.
You see, now, you would be just the perfect person.
Mm-hmm.
In the winter of next year, are you going to be here in the winter or are you going to be
probably.
Done?
Okay, I'll be
in the
done,
winter
I'll
we'll
be
have
right.
our course called Cultural Resource Management.
Mm-hmm.
And it's given about every 2 years. And when you take that course, it teaches you everything there is to know about preservation and restoration laws and how to satisfy state and federal requirements on preservation and everything like
mm-hmm.
that. And we give it, and each student takes a site locally,
mm-hmm.
and they have to walk it all the way through to it. Is presented in Columbus. They go down with me and they make the presentation and they go from taking the photographs, the archival research, the whole background thing. They all take a favorite site of theirs. And to get an A, you have to have that done by the end of the quarter. Now, it doesn't have to be finally, it doesn't have to necessarily get on the register. If, for example, there's some reason why it doesn't ultimately get on, that still doesn't keep you from getting your A. What an A constitutes is, I have it in my hand, I think it's a beautiful, nominable job, and what they decide ultimately doesn't count. And last year, I think I had, last time we had it, we had 8 people in the class. 6 of them made it to that final stand. That doesn't mean you automatically get an A. That
mm-hmm.
means that you can't get an A without it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, just
but
so you present a good case.
That's right. Everything has to be done. You can't say my photographs are coming tomorrow. The whole package has
mm-hmm.
to be done by the last day of the
mm-hmm.
class. And 6 of the 8 made it, and the 2 that didn't make it for reasons. They didn't take their pictures till late, and one of them didn't have their pictures back. And that's,
mm-hmm.
you can't cry foul ball. You know from the beginning what your limitations
okay.
are. You get out and you do it. But anyway, we put Stamball on.
Mm-hmm.
We put Jones Hall on. That's the most recent. We put Ohio 1 on. We put the White Cemetery Bridge in Poland on. And we put Hamilton Dam in Poland on. And in the winter of next year, we'll have probably 8 or 10 students in there. They will each take another site. If the schoolhouse is not on, you can take it.
Mm-hmm.
And they start and they move it right through to the end. And we show them how to do it. And we show them what the federal requirements are for significance, how to determine significance in a building,
mm-hmm.
and all that. So we were going to hold it this spring. We didn't have any, but we only had 3 people sign up.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why is, we're just not making contact with the right departments. We had 3 anthropologists who were taking,
mm-hmm.
but if we had gotten the word to the history department, we could have
mm-hmm.
had some of you people in
yeah.
it. See what I mean? Because if you're going to be in the history, it'd be a valuable course for you.
That was one of my other questions.
Carol Mills took it from the history department. You know Carol?
Yes, I know Carol.
Carol took it.
Uh-huh. Why you're doing this historical archaeology work. Why is there no connection with the history department?
You can answer the question for yourself, I suppose. I don't know why there isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Archaeology is a technique,
yeah.
which arises out of the anthropological discipline.
Mm-hmm.
But the data of historical archaeology is historical data. That is, I could just as easily be working for a history department
mm-hmm.
as when I do historical archaeology. But see, I do prehistoric too. I do anthropological archaeology too.
Mm-hmm.
But when I do a building like the one in Mansfield, I'm doing it as much for the historians. There isn't another anthropologist in the group. They're all historians that are interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
See? So you bring a good question. Here's the ideal state. The ideal state would be that we had a course here called Historical Archaeology. That had a field course in the summer that dug for 5 weeks, and that it was, if not a requirement, a course elective, highly regarded by the history department. I don't think they don't have it because they don't like it. Mm-hmm. I've always had a good rapport with the history department.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because no one's ever taken the initiative. But in other places like William and Mary, which has a good history department, they also have a significant MA program in historical archaeology.
Mm-hmm.
Sean Gallagher is another guy. He's a history major. I always wanted Sean to be the first student at YSU to do for his MA thesis a historical archaeological project. He would be the first one ever. That is, he's dug with me half a dozen times at Quakertown, for example. I was going to turn over to him all of my data on one aspect of what we were doing out there and say, here, make your MA thesis out. Right?
And he wouldn't do it.
Well, you know, Sean?
Yeah.
He's kind of a flake. You know what I mean? And he's one of those kinds of guys that if he ever gets in the mail, he's surprised because he's a flake. And I don't mean, I like Sean. He digs with me, but it has to be somebody with industry to do it. But
mm-hmm.
I think he'd be a marvelous. I think the first person that did it would have a shoe-in MA thesis. I think they'd have
mm-hmm.
one that would lend itself perfectly. I'm digging all the time. I'm digging at the Deem House in Boardman, you know, the barn.
Mm-hmm.
I dig every summer for 8 weeks at Quakertown. If a historical person went along with me on this, and went along not just to dig, but at the time they were digging, to look for content for an MA thesis, they'd have themselves a bonus. But I've never, you know, I've had Nick Cardulius, you know Nick?
Mm-hmm.
He got his MA up there, Nick's on.
Yeah.
He's been with me, and Sean, and Neil Yuckin. But other than them, and he's another flake. I like Neil too, but again, he's the same. And Carol,
mm-hmm.
if I could get somebody who was really a student from up there, boy, they could go anywhere with this stuff. No, that's the answer to your question. There's no good reason why not.
Mm-hmm. But like you said, there has been connection with the department through students.
Through. But not through faculty.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, there's a kind of a relationship between me and Jimmy Ronda because he's an
mm-hmm.
ethnohistorian, and that,
mm-hmm.
that's as close to anthro.
Mm-hmm.
He's the closest one to anthro in the department. And then behind him there'd be Hugh, who does oral history, and that's oral history interfaces with anthro. Since you're actually
right.
talking to living people, it makes it kind of field work.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I have a lot of my students take that. You know, I say that's a good thing for them to learn how to interview.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk them into taking his History of the West, and he has people taking my Indians course around with it.
Mm-hmm.
So we have good relationships. But we never made that one cross stitch, which I think we should. I think that more of the history majors should be taking,
mm-hmm.
well, they should be on the archaeological digs with me, the historical ones anyway. Now, if we had it in the program to teach a course like that would be dandy.
Or even a suggested course.
It could be taught every couple of years instead
yeah.
of every year.
Yeah.
We could make it even a graduate course. You know, you could even make a part of the graduate program and limit it to graduate students, you know what I mean, and have
yeah.
them taught every couple of years for 4 hours credit.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And then, I think if they took it, they'd have such an appreciation. It would so broaden their historical education to see what it is. Because when you hire up, you go into your terminal degree ultimately, you teach history, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, when you get to where you're going, you're gonna see historical sites around, and you might want to do something about developing them from an archaeological point of view. You'd never be able to do it had you never had any training. You'd have to go down to the anthro department. So.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at a restoration project, as you said, there's more to a restoration than the building itself.
I'm, up until a couple of years ago, I was the only historical archaeologist in the state. And up until a few years ago, wherever they had these restoration projects, they called me from all over, and I couldn't go to all of them. Canals and one thing or another.
Mm-hmm.
But now the realization by other anthropologists that there's a real need here has caused several of them to branch into
mm-hmm.
historical. So there are more doing it now, fortunately.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But I still have more than my hands full. Mm-hmm. I can sleep the master bureau. I can't do that. And so they won't have anybody trained to do it. Now, what I'll do is I'll try to con one of my students. See, if you were one of my students, now this is why I'm talking about in a real sense. If you had been on digs with me, mm-hmm. say for the last couple of years you've been out with me digging these various things, and you were an MA student, I'd say, what's your name?
Michelle.
Michelle, I'd say, look at here. There's a perfect opportunity for you to have your first dig. And I would take you up there with me the first time, and I would show you what we would do if I was directing it, and then I'd say, here you are, Michelle, there's a dig for you. And you would take this dig group, and you would dig the site the way I had shown you to dig in the last couple of years, and then that would be your baby. And then you could, if it was anything other than this site, you could work that into your MA thesis. You see what I mean? Because the things that come out of these, for God's sakes, are not skimpy. I mean, if I go out and dig a site like the Barnhartville house, which is just the wing of a house, okay? If I do just the wing of a house, this is camera ready. Here you go. This is just the wing of the house with its photos. You've got right here, you've got 112 pages, not counting the photos, which I number. Mm-hmm. Plus all the tables. That's nice. Look at the size of that, and that's just for a wing. Yeah. This is just you're talking about the result of about 4 weeks' work. Field work. Adds up to that. Mm-hmm. And in most cases, it would generate so much data. Mm-hmm. I could get massive theses for people every time one of these sites came up. I wouldn't have to worry about me doing it all, which I do now. You see, I could say, okay, here's what they want at the Oak Hill Cottage. Mm-hmm. Let's go do it. You do it. Then you could add you'd also have the distinct advantage of being a historian, of being able to add that historical dimension. The difference between the Barnhartville house as a terminus on the Underground Railroad and the Hubbard house in Ashtabula. Mm-hmm. A comparison. What a nice thing.
Okay? Good. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. I never had trouble selling students.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably as much my fault as anybody's that it hasn't been, because I'm so busy doing my own thing now, I don't really have to try to sell the history department to make use of them. I already got so many people I can service.
Mm-hmm.
There's always been at least one history major, always an undergraduate, that has been interested in it. Carol Mills, again, she was casually interested in it, but Nick was an anthro undergraduate and a history. He got a dual major, and then he went on to graduate school in anthro, and then back to history here. Now he's going into anthro for his PhD. Sean Gallagher, he was history. We seduced him into archaeology because he liked it. He's been on dates with us. But I don't know where he's going with his degree now. He's probably almost finished with it.
I think he's finished this course.
His BA? Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. And
I haven't seen him in a while.
And he was always going to go to graduate school here
and
do that thesis on the Cowley Company over there.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to do that. I'd love to work with somebody. I'd love to have one of those people do a thesis on a subject that was archaeological and historical too, so that I could participate at that level, you know, because I've never had anybody. I have tons of data. I'd love to just say, here, you do it.
Okay. Someone interested in doing a master's thesis comes down here from the history department. They've had a casual interest in archaeology, you know, taken a couple of the archaeology classes or the intro archaeology class. What would you say to them? How would you,
and they were
how would you direct them?
Okay, what I would do is, depending on how much education they've had and how much time they've got on their maintenance, okay, suppose you were the one. Suppose it was you, and you came down and you said, Dr. White, I can't find an MA thesis project, you see?
Mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking about maybe doing something in historical archaeology or restoration related to archaeology.
Mm-hmm.
I would say to you, okay, what have you had? And you'd say, well, I have all the history in the world. I'm a good student.
Mm-hmm.
I had intro arc with Fry.
Mm-hmm.
So none of you had, because you didn't have me, and I'm the only other one. So You had it with Fry, and I liked it. I understood what he was talking about. I say, have you had a dig course? And you'd say no. I'd say, okay, well, what you need to have before you could get a real understanding is to get yourself out in the field. And you would say to me, okay, well, I'm not doing anything this summer. I would say, take the field course, 6 hours credit, and learn what archaeology is. Now, I say, if you take it with Fry, it's prehistoric. You'll learn all the techniques and everything, but it won't be historical. You won't be digging walls and foundations.
Mm-hmm.
Or I say, come with me this summer when I dig Quakertown, starting about the middle of July for the rest of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Or when I go to Sackett's Harbor up on Lake Ontario to dig the British war dead that were buried during the War of 1812. Come along with me as a member of the crew, volunteer member of the crew, and work with other archaeologists, and I'll show you what historical archaeology is all about. And then read this dozen books about historical archaeology, you know,
mm-hmm.
and find out the theoretical frame as to how it applies. Then I'll say, look at this. Look at this powder mill over here. We have over at Quakertown, we have an industry that came into existence at the turn of the century and grew to 25 acres, black powder manufacture. And then went out of business in the early 1927. Here you got a perfect opportunity to study an industry, the birth, rise, and demise of an industry. Through the archives, it was purchased by the DuPont Company, who were building dynamite, so bought a bunch of black powder people and threw them out of business. That is, they didn't want the competition with dynamite, see? So you could send to DuPont, get all the records, the historical nature. You could go out there, the ruins are all over the place. The ruins are around, you know, 50 years, 60 years old. Photographs. You could have a photographic record. You'd have the archive record. So far, a nice history. You could go around and interview half a dozen people who worked in that powder mill who are still alive that I've talked to that live over in that area. You could do the oral history. You could tape all their occurrences while they worked at the furnace. And then you could go out there archaeologically and sample. They measure the test units in all the structures to determine what their function was. And you could make a statement as to how archaeology helps to piece together the old thing. It would make a magnificent report and a nice prototype of what a historical site report should be. That's what I would say to you. That's what I'd say to anybody. Now, if they came down like Sean, he's got it made because Sean's been on digs with me for a couple of summers, and he's got a good anthro background that you need to apply the archaeological aspects, see?
Mm-hmm.
So with him, I would just say, okay, here's what you do. But somebody who has no experience, they'd have to make up for the slack.
Yeah.
That's how I would do it.
I see. Okay, just one other question.
Mm-hmm.
How does historical archaeology differ from prehistoric?
Its major difference is only in the time frame that's involved, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But that makes a big difference. That at first sounds like just a quantitative difference. And it is, in
mm-hmm.
a sense. But it's such a big difference that it becomes qualitative. That is, you say, well, it's only the difference between one that's 2,000 years old and one that's 100 years old. But that difference can be measured in the fact that in one case you're digging nothing but soil and you're paying rapt attention to the detail of soil horizons and pollen in the soils and microscopic differences and subtle differences between the way a point is made, a flake stone tool here, that's prehistoric.
Mm-hmm.
And in historic, you're talking about walls that are 3 feet thick, made out of limestone, flags that are stacked, walkways, things of such gross nature that they overwhelm you. I mean, it's just technically different digging a hole in the ground in which the artifacts seem to be suspended in dirt. You understand
mm-hmm.
what I mean?
Yeah.
And one where you dig and you have walls and a cement floor. And the techniques are the same. You dig with a shovel and a trowel and a whisper
mm-hmm.
room, and you take your record your data where it's found, and then you interpret why it's there.
Mm-hmm.
But in historical data, you have the record to go to compare it with. You have all kinds of analyses you wouldn't have in prehistoric. For example, if you find pottery, prehistoric pottery, if you find china in a historic site, it might say it came from Scranton, came from Wilkes-Barre. You have all sorts of interconnections with other places, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Plus you have a historical record to rely on. In historical archaeology, after you've dug a site or before, you can go to the historical record and find out all the available information on a site. Now, I dug a site at Quakertown, for example. I dug a site at Quakertown in which the master house, the house that belonged to the master, was dug by us. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Here I am standing to make a long story short, I dig this. Here's the foundation. She's standing against the corner of an old building, of which only that's left. We dug that out, okay? Here it is again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, man sent me this picture of that house at the turn of the century. I blew these up from the old negative.
Mm-hmm.
But here's that same corner that person's standing at right there. So, I've got these to go on. So, let me give you a for instance. Prehistoric, I'd never be able to check against this. So what I like to do is, I dug this whole thing out with no building there. Didn't know what it looked like. I like to be able to say, okay, now, I can tell you where all the windows were.
From a foundation?
From the foundation. I was able to predict all these windows. And then, I never knew I'd be able to for sure prove it until
uh-huh.
I saw this picture years later.
Uh-huh.
But the sash weights that went into those windows, when the building fell, the sash weights fell to the ground below.
Okay.
And so I found four here, and I knew it was two stories,
mm-hmm.
and that they were right under the windows.
Hmm.
See?
I see.
And
uh-huh.
so, I mean, it's just, I could tell how far out the eaves came,
uh-huh.
because I excavated carefully out here and found the drip line, where, if you look where the water pours over your gutters
mm-hmm.
and lands, there's a little gravel patch there,
yeah.
where the water, well, it gets covered with soil, but it still exists underneath the ground. So I can tell a lot. Then when I have a picture, I can test it. I can look at it, and I can check it out and see what's what, see?
Mm-hmm.
So you can't do that in prehistoric. You don't have the means to check yourself. But the big difference is simply that if you wanted to be a historical archaeologist, a historical dig would be more valuable to you
mm-hmm.
because you would be dealing with artifacts and stuff from the historic period, stuff you'd be dealing with. I'd say this, though. I'd say if you had to learn to be an archaeologist of either kind, you're best to have your training as a prehistorian first, because it's a lot more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Here you are, you don't have foundations, you don't know where walls are, you know, it's all dirt.
Mm-hmm.
If you could become really good at that, then when you get into a historic site, it's relatively
mm-hmm.
easy, because everything's presented in spades.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah. But a lot of kids that do both archaeology, they enjoy prehistoric more sometimes. Because of the antiquity. If you dig with a site with me that's only 80 years old, there's nothing particularly exciting about finding broken bottles that are 80 years old. I mean, a broken glass of 20 looks the same as one of
yeah.
80. But when you're digging a site, but you find a lot. So it compensates by giving you volume. But when you dig a prehistoric site, and you're not finding much, and you dig and you find a point. So digging down and you turn over, where the hell is that point? Well, I find this thing here. Or this pendant. There's a pendant, abalone pendant.
Uh-huh.
If you find that, and I tell you this is 2,000 years old, suddenly it adds a new dimension to it.
Yeah.
It's not like a broken bottle. Not everybody
yeah.
finds these tools.
Sure.
So that's just the antiquity.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay?
Okay.
Help any?